We end today with Democratic Senator Dick Durbin questioning Dr. Christine Blasey Ford.
Last night, the Republican staff of this committee released to the media a timeline that shows that they've interviewed two people who claimed they were the ones who actually assaulted you. I'm asking you to address this new defense of mistaken identity directly. Dr. Ford, with what degree of certainty do you believe Brett Kavanaugh assaulted you?
100%.
100%.
That was Dr. Christine Blasey Ford being questioned by Senator Durbin. And that ends our highlights of the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing. Historic moment. The Senate Judiciary Committee is scheduled to vote today on the confirmation of Judge Kavanaugh. That does it for our show, Democracy Now! Produced with the help of Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills. Special thanks to Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman.
And it is 5 o'clock here at KBOO Portland. Up next is your Friday edition of the KBOO Evening News.
In celebration of our 50th anniversary, KBOO is teaming up with the Mississippi Records Music and Film Series. KBOO will be hosting Killer of Sheep on Wednesday, October 3rd at 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. Filmed in Watts in 1975, Killer of Sheep follows a working man in a moment of existential crisis, trying to make ends meet at a job he finds repugnant, and trying to connect with his family and community. The Library of Congress declared Killer of Sheep a national treasure and one of the first 50 films on the National Film Registry. Again, that's Killer of Sheep on Wednesday, October 3rd at 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, KBOO Portland.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Columbia Land Trust, working to connect people with the nature of the Northwest with community-driven conservation and stewardship. More information, including tours, events, and volunteer opportunities, online at columbialandtrust.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Senate Democrats walk out on the Kavanaugh hearing.
TriMet commits to electric buses.
And Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley addresses cannabis businesses at the Portland Hilton.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, September 28th, 2018. I'm Teresa Mitchell.
And I'm Linda Olson-Osterlund. Outraged at the refusal by the Republican-controlled Senate Judicial Committee to have the FBI investigate sexual assault allegations against Supreme Court nominee Judge Brett Kavanaugh, Democratic senators walked out of the meeting today and held an impromptu news conference in the hallways outside the meeting room. Here are comments by Senators Mazie Hirono, Kamala Harris, and Sheldon Whitehouse, as well as Richard Blumenthal.
I'm here standing with my colleagues because it's very clear that the Republicans will break every norm, every rule to get this person on the Supreme Court, where he will be there with a cloud, he will weaken the court, and this has got to stop. So I walked out. I'm not going to participate in this charade anymore.
You know, one of our colleagues talked about this being a sham. This is a sham what's going on in there right now. Democrats are not being heard. They're pushing through this process. And frankly, the statements yesterday were about bullying fellow senators. And from top to bottom, this has been about bullies. Listen to the people. All we have asked for is that there be an FBI investigation. Dr. Ford came in and she poured out her heart. She cooperated with the process. She gave the process dignity and respect. The least we could do is give her the dignity and respect of having a process that has credibility. We are talking about putting somebody on the United States Supreme Court for a lifetime. For the sake of our democracy and the integrity of our democracy, you would think that members of the United States Senate would say, wait a minute, there's enough here to push pause. Let's reflect on what we're about to do. This is not a statement about the best of who we are in terms of a system that is about to be and is supposed to be about justice.
Senator Harris, what should happen now?
I am here to join my colleagues in objecting to the sham process that is going forward right now, right next to us in the Judiciary Committee. This adds to the sequence of sham process that we have seen. I think it is unprecedented in the history of background investigations for new and credible allegations to come forward and the background investigation not be reopened. All three credible allegations have received zero investigation by the FBI. That is not right. The partisanship that was on display in yesterday's hearing was not right. It was not right from my colleagues. It was particularly not right from the nominee. I have never seen such a display of vengeful, partisan, conspiracy theory behavior from somebody seeking any judgeship, let alone a seat on the Supreme Court. And now we have this sham process in the committee, which raises the question, why? Why are they so desperate to get this person on the court without a proper investigation? Thanks.
What we're watching is a betrayal. It is, first and foremost, a betrayal of the United States Senate's constitutional duty to advise and consent. That duty can be done only if we uncover all of the facts, good or bad, about a nominee. There has been no adequate FBI investigation. There has been no sufficient fact-finding. There has been barely a process of considering the people who ought to be heard. Yesterday, we heard from a powerfully credible sexual assault survivor. This process betrays all the hollow, hypocritical respect that our Republican colleagues said they were going to give her. Ramming through this nomination without hearing from Mark Judge and other relevant witnesses and without any investigation is a betrayal of our promise to those sexual assault victims that they would be heard respectively. And this process is being watched. All of America is watching the United States Senate today, and they should be deeply disappointed, embarrassed, ashamed of supposedly the world's greatest deliberative body sinking to a low that denies sexual assault survivors the right to be heard. There are two that should be called as witnesses. There are other witnesses like Mark Judge who need to be called about this nominee, and there needs to be an FBI investigation. Trained professionals, not the staff of the Judiciary Committee. Trained professionals, not a conclusory six-sentence statement, not even under oath, from the attorney for Mark Judd. The real facts, the real story here has not been told. And make no mistake, the truth will come out about Brett Kavanaugh. It's only a matter of time. The truth will come out.
The Democratic plan is really a plan that is to reach out to all Americans because people are watching. And I want to acknowledge the presence of all of our friends from the U.S. House of Representatives who are standing with us. The American people have got to rise up and recognize this railroad job for what it is. I have no words left. You know that we've all been very rational and reasonable. We're always being told, why don't you, you know, observe decorum? Are you kidding me?
It can
what
be summarized
there
in
is,
no
okay,
rules,
summarize it.
No rules, no norms,
yeah.
No respect.
Exactly.
And what we're going to do is make our case to the American people, because they will rise up. The American people are on our side. That's what we're going to do in the next 24 hours.
I'll be on the floor of the Senate giving the statement that I would have made.
That was Senators Hirano, Harris, Whitehouse, and Blumenthal on their walkout of the Supreme Court confirmation hearings today. Their tactic was successful, and the Republican majority agreed to delay the hearings for a week to allow for an FBI investigation of the allegations against Kavanaugh.
Senator Jeff Merkley addressed the International Cannabis Business Conference via teleconference today at the Portland Hilton Hotel. Here's what he had to say.
Greetings, I'm Senator Jeff Merkley, and welcome to the International Cannabis Business Conference. In state after state, the American people have stood up to say that it's time to change cannabis laws in America. That's why 4 years ago, I was proud as an Oregonian to support Measure 91 and become the first United States Senator to vote for legalizing cannabis in my home state. Now I'm working with my colleagues in Washington to help make these changes at the national level. Because here's what we know about the impact of legalizing cannabis for the states that have done it. More jobs, more tax revenues, fewer arrests, and a second chance for individuals convicted of minor drug offenses who have had their records expunged. Just look at the effect right here in Oregon. The Fiscal Impact Committee originally predicted that legalizing cannabis would generate between $17 and $40 million a year for the state. But the state is on track to double the higher end of that projection and bring in more than $80 million a year. 40% of that revenue goes right back into our schools. That's roughly $34 million for our students and teachers. 20% goes into mental health, alcoholism, and drug services. Another $12 to $13 million for the state police, and over $4 million for the Oregon Health Authority. And Oregon isn't alone. The same kinds of benefits can be seen in Colorado, and in Washington State, and in Nevada, all of which have seen actual revenue beat the initial estimates. The time has come for us to change the way our country looks at and deals with cannabis. And I'm working in Washington to make that happen. I've introduced the Safe Banking Act to ensure that legitimate businesses following state cannabis laws have the same access to resources and services that every other business has. Not too long ago, I went and saw for myself how business owners cut off from services and opportunities have to pay taxes, stuffing backpacks and duffel bags full of cash and driving hours to Salem to deposit it. There is no reason that if a state has voted to legalize, business owners should have to operate this way. It's burdensome. And it's dangerous. Billions of dollars in cash is great for organized crime. It's great for money laundering. It's great for cheating on wages and taxes. So we would all benefit by banking the cannabis economy. We also need to make sure that hemp products with low THC are not regulated under the Controlled Substances Act. And I'm proud that this change has been included in the Senate Farm Bill this year. While we still need to get the Farm Bill over the finish line, getting rid of this illogical restriction will help create jobs and strengthen the agricultural sector across the United States. In addition, I'm working with Senator Booker on the Marijuana Justice Act to decriminalize cannabis, stop racially disproportionate enforcement of cannabis crimes, and give those convicted of past use of possession crimes a clean slate. And I'm a co-sponsor of Senator Schumer's Marijuana Freedom Opportunity Act, which would also decriminalize cannabis throughout the nation. Times are changing. The American people are demanding change to how we treat cannabis across our nation. They know the benefits that legalizing cannabis brings, socially, economically, and in our justice system. And I'm determined to help bring about those changes. And I'm thrilled to be working in partnership with all of you to do it.
According to the climate solutions activist Mara Gross, this week the TriMet board voted unanimously to adopt the 2018 TriMet non-diesel plan, committing to transitioning their transit fleet completely off diesel buses by 2040. They plan to begin buying electric buses and prioritize routes through low-income neighborhoods which bear disproportionate burdens of air pollution. TriMet is the 11th largest bus fleet in the country and the largest user of diesel in Oregon. TriMet will join other transit agencies from Seattle, Los Angeles, New York City, and elsewhere that are committing to zero-emission bus fleets. Climate Solutions Oregon State Director Meredith Connolly issued a statement saying, quote, "By committing to transitioning off diesel buses, TriMet is embracing a clean energy vision for our region," end quote. TriMet's move towards zero-emission electric buses is a significant step for cleaner air, better health, and reduced climate pollution. The benefits of electric buses will continue to increase as the electric grid becomes powered by mostly carbon-free energy over the next two decades. TriMet already has some diesel-electric buses and has been courted by the nascent electric bus industry for a few years now.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. At 6, it's Bread and Roses. Then at 7, Davey D brings you Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather calls for a low of 55 degrees in the Portland area. Tomorrow it may rain, and the high will be in the low 70s. Today in history, in 1968, the Beatles' single Hey Jude hit the top of the charts. At over 7 minutes long, was the longest song ever to hit number one. A tiny 10-watt station called KBOO Radio was already broadcasting. The quote of the day is from John Lennon, who said, quote, "A dream you dream alone is only a dream. A dream you dream together is reality."
And now, here is On the Ground, a roundup of the week's news from award-winning journalist Esther Ivarim in Washington, D.C.
Welcome to On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, voices of resistance from the nation's capital. I'm Esther Ivarim. Protests continue daily here and around the country in opposition to the Kavanaugh nomination, and these rallies did not stop on Thursday as Christine Blasey Ford told the Senate committee that she is, quote, 100% sure, end quote, that Kavanaugh sexually assaulted and attempted to rape her when they were both in high school. On Thursday, Tarana Burke, founder of the Me Too movement, addressed protesters outside in the rain after hundreds had just rallied inside the Hart Senate office building.
This is what the movement is.
Yes. Yes.
The white people, they will call it all kind of things on the news. They will report about it in all kind of ways. Look around, look next to you. Look behind you, we are the movement. All of the people who stood up and said Me Too, all of the people who said we believe survivors, all of the people who took off of work, who are watching at home, who are standing in the rain, this is the movement. Yeah. Listen, we don't owe these people our stories. We generously give our stories away.
Yeah.
We don't owe them anything. This is not our burden to bear.
Yeah.
These people owe us. They are accountable to us. Our communities need to be less vulnerable to sexual violence, and we do what we can, but it's not our burden to bear. And I'm telling you, we are laying down our burdens. We are laying our burdens down right here at the Senate. We are laying our burdens down in front of the people who are we elected to represent us. It is not our burden to bear. We believe survivors, we validate each other, and that's enough. The rest is up to them. Do your job. Kavanaugh should not be a candidate if they did their jobs. Told our stories, we've used our hashtags, we've marched, we've sang, we've screamed, we've yelled. Lay your burden down. It is not our burden to bear. Yes. Let them do their job.
Earlier this week, Code Pink Women for Peace put the focus on how U.S. policies are impacting women outside the U.S., particularly in Iran, which is targeted by the United States for new economic sanctions. Chantel James has more.
On Tuesday night at Busboys and Poets 450 K Street location, a panel discussion titled How Sanctions Impact Women and the Women's Movement in Iran was held before a packed room. Panelists were Medea Benjamin of Code Pink, Nazil Fathi, author and former New York Times correspondent, Fari Malik Madani, film director and producer, and Sahan Tamasebi, director of Femina. At a time when Trump argues before the UN for isolating Iran, the conversation explored the impact of sanctions on Iranian women and the state of women's lives in the country since the revolution. The panelists argued that Iranians are not the enemy and that the impact of sanctions on the lives of its people extends even once the sanctions have been lifted. Nazil Fathi explains this impact further, telling those gathered that reform to the legal system in Iran that would grant women war rights is not even possible when people have no diapers for their children and the sick do not have their medicine. From Northwest DC, this is Chantal James.
Thank you, Chantal. And speaking of Iran, I had the chance to sit down with Professor Gerald Horn on Thursday, and we discussed both the laughter and derision at President Trump on the world stage at the United Nations and the tears, sobbing, and yelling by a Supreme Court nominee speaking before Congress on a national stage. Here I am with Professor Gerald Horn here in downtown D.C. after a pretty tumultuous day, or I should say even week, because we had Donald Trump go to the United Nations and really put on what the Iranian president described rightly as a kind of display of Nazism in terms of our relationship to the whole world and our invasions and our right to do that. And then we had this total meltdown by a Supreme Court nominee, Brett Kavanaugh, in what many of us saw as just meltdown of white male elitism and just not being able to handle being challenged.
Well, in both cases, we're talking about privilege. In the first instance, we're talking about imperial privilege. In the second instance, we're talking about an offshoot of imperial privilege, which, of course, is race privilege and gender privilege, male supremacy in the first place. With regard to Iran, it's striking to note that Mr. Trump, in some ways, was outstripped by his national security advisor, John Bolton, who talked about Tehran having hell to pay unless it towed the U.S. line. It's remarkable to note that just a few days ago, there was an attack on an Iranian military parade that led to dozens of deaths in Iran. In 2017, there was an attack on the Iranian parliament that led to a similar amount of bloodshed. It's striking to note that Mr. Trump has promised that he will be tightening sanctions on Iran. We'll expect the European Union to do the same. This will be quite a test for the European Union, that is to say, whether or not they're going to be a puppet for Uncle Sam or whether they're going to stand on their feet and be independent. As of now, there are signs towards the latter. They talked about enacting a barter regime with the Iranians, that is to say, circumventing the U.S. dollar by bartering Iranian oil for a like amount of European Union goods. They're also talking about trying to establish the euro as an alternative to the U.S. dollar. So we'll have to keep our eyes upon that, as we'll have to keep our eyes upon the fact that Mr. Trump also met with Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, this week at the United Nations. And surely you can be certain that they were cooking up a further conflict with Iran.
Iran wasn't the only target of Trump, also China and Venezuela. And these are very serious issues.
Well, first, with regard to Venezuela, the New York Times had an article a few days ago about how in 2017, the Trump regime was meeting with dissident military officers in Caracas with the aim of coordinating a military overthrow of the Maduro regime. At the same time, it was announced this week that a number of neighbors of Venezuela will be taking the Maduro regime to the International Criminal Court. They're invoking this discredited doctrine of responsibility to protect, which was used in 2011 to overthrow the Gaddafi regime. That is to say, they're arguing that someone has to protect the Venezuelan citizenry against the Maduro regime, which would presumably lead to a similar kind of military invasion of Venezuela, presumably from these neighbors that are taking Venezuela to the ICC. Obviously, I'm sure listeners note the contradiction about Mr. Trump trashing the ICC when it comes to a possible investigation of U.S. war crimes in Afghanistan and elsewhere, and then trying to use the ICC when it comes to trying to overthrow the Maduro regime. The situation in China, with regard to China, might be the most serious of them all. Not only the trade sanctions, but the fact that the United States is contemplating hundreds of millions of dollars in weapon sales to Taiwan, the rebel province that China claims as its own. This comes in the context of jousting in the South China Sea between the Chinese military and the U.S. military. This comes in the wake of military maneuvers on the Russian-Chinese border, with Russia and China coordinating their militaries, hundreds of thousands of troops, with Washington feeling that those kinds of maneuvers are actually aimed at the United States of America. The rhetoric is becoming more heated on the U.S. side with regard to China. And I'm afraid to say that it's not outlandish to rule out the possibility of some sort of military conflict between the United States and China.
Here in D.C. this week, I know that you were probably riveted to the screen on Thursday in terms of the hearings for the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. Now, I know that in terms of your own schooling and then being a professor, you've definitely come into contact with the white male elite, young white men who come from privileged backgrounds, went to private schools. So when you saw the testimony and statement by Kavanaugh on Thursday, what was your take?
My take was, first of all, with regard to the first half of the hearing, I found that Dr. Blasey Ford was a persuasive and indeed compelling witness. With regard to Judge Kavanaugh, I expected him at any moment to talk about a high-tech lynching, invoking the words of Clarence Thomas some 27-odd years ago. He went on the offensive. He impugned the integrity of the Democrats. He suggested that there was some sort of vast left-wing conspiracy. And it's interesting that the Republicans were quite keen to suggest that there were, in their words, two victims. That is to say, they did not want to attack Dr. Blasey Ford, presumably feeling that they want to make sure that Euro-American women who are of a centrist political position might not be alienated. And so therefore, they did not attack her. They cast her as a victim and Justice Kavanaugh as a victim. I have to say that becoming familiar with the Ivy League as a teenager, I was not very surprised by the white supremacy that I experienced. But I have to say, I was a bit taken aback by the misogyny, particularly towards Euro-American women, and the contempt for Euro-American women. That really took me aback, and I think it helped to shape my consciousness, not only with regard to opposition to male chauvinism and male supremacy, but also with regard to getting a deeper understanding of the kind of privilege that these men of European descent feel that they are destined to exercise. I think that in their heart of hearts, they feel that their right-wing politics is what helped to dispossess the Native Americans and enslave the Africans, and that therefore they built this country from their point of view, and that they have a right, almost a divine right, to rule. It's almost a throwback to monarchies of the 18th and 17th century. So Justice Kavanaugh, I don't think, did himself any favors, at least from my point of view, with regard to his rather aggressive approach at that particular hearing. And I'll be interested to see what Mr. Trump says in his memoir about the blubbering and the crying of Judge Kavanaugh during that hearing, which was really quite something.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News for Friday, September 28, 2018. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. The producer is Teresa Mitchell, and our engineer is Aaron Yankee. The interim directors of Evening News and Public Affairs are Sam Bowman and Teresa Mitchell. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund.
And I'm Teresa Mitchell. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO at 7, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, more talk radio with Cecil and Celeste. At 9 o'clock on Monday morning, the Old Mole Variety Hour burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time. At 10 on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein will welcome Nick Abraham with Yes on 1631, the Washington initiative that would put a fee on the state's largest polluters. At 11 o'clock in the morning on Monday, the Radio Zine introduces a new Diane Wade House, a program dedicated to curbing the disparities for African-American women within the justice system. And at 11:30, Madness Radio, voices and visions from outside of mental health. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, listeners may know that Donald Trump's big speech at the UN General Assembly was met with laughter. But another funny, not funny event that took place was largely overlooked. At a sort of glorified photo op, Trump announced a new plan.